Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you. Tracy Osborne is with us as well, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa, also with the Iowa Public Policy Center. And Tracy, welcome back to you in our Iowa City studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We want to talk for a good deal of the program about the continuing revelations about sexual harassment and the implications of that on our national politics. Of course, if you pay attention to state politics in I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Tracy, in nearly every state, there are legislatures going through the throes of the same things, and our state is no exception.
That's correct. In fact, California is starting a commission on what to do about problems in their legislature. They have somebody who is accused. And I think, you know, our legislature is not really meeting right now, but I think we might see something happen when they come back in January.
Okay. Let's go to our federal capital and talk about developments there. Democratic Senator Al Franken continuing to apologize after allegations of improper groping from several women. On Monday, Franken spoke briefly with reporters in D.C. He said he was embarrassed and knows it will be difficult to regain trust.
I'm going to try to learn from my mistakes. And in doing so, I've been doing a lot of reflecting, and I want to be someone who adds something to this conversation, and I hope I can do that.
Okay, Al Franken on Monday. Franken also suggesting he would be open to having the results of an ethics investigation open to the public. Rachel, reaction of the Democrats, specifically Al Franken, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I think the Democrats have found themselves in an awkward position here. They really have claimed the moral high ground on these questions of sexual harassment. And when, you know, when they're faced with allegations from within their own caucus, not just Al Franken, but John Conyers as well, we're seeing some mixed messages come out. And I think the Democratic leadership is struggling to find their own footing to figure out how they want to deal with this while maintaining the moral high ground. Mm-hmm. And that's been tough.
Of course, more pressure on Representative John Conyers, one of the most high-profile lawmakers to be caught in this uproar over sexual harassment in the workplace, an increasing number of allegations against him continuing to grow. Rachel, can he hold on? Can he weather this?
It's unclear. He's the oldest serving or the longest serving member of Congress at this point, 88 years old. And, you know, if you go to the Sunday talk shows and listen to what Nancy Pelosi said about John Conyers, it was clear that, you know, she was really struggling to walk the tightrope here and figure out how to appease some of his active constituencies, most notably the Congressional Black Caucus. But the Congressional Black Caucus now also appears to be calling on him to resign. You know, this is not the way anybody wants to end their congressional career. But I think it may be time for him to do so.
That being said, isn't that seat fairly safe in Democratic hands, given where he's from?
Yeah,
I don't think so. Your thoughts, Tracy, on how the Democrats are handling both Conyers, Al Franken?
I think Rachel's right. You know, Conyers has this civil rights history that's always made him pretty popular. And I mean, Al Franken is a very visible member of Congress. And so for them to have to confront these two pretty well-liked people and pretty, you know, credible accusations against both of them is a real problem for their caucus. Both as, you know, trying to say that we're the party who supports doing something more active about these sexual misconduct allegations, and on the other hand, not wanting to lose their numbers, you know, the precious numbers that they have, even as the minority. You know, it puts them in a little bit of a spot, particularly, too, because Franken's been so upfront about apologizing immediately, right, even if he's
criticized for that tack, Tracy? Do you think that's a good tack?
That's a good question.
Seems to come from the heart. I mean, as much as we can judge from audio, right, and video.
I do think so. You know, and I hesitate to say these words, but I think you have to give him some credit for being one of the few people to come out and say, gosh, I wish I hadn't done that, instead of just saying, oh, I didn't do that, when the evidence is pretty clear. But I now wonder if he's regretting it as the pressure is coming down on him to discuss whether he might resign.
Mm-hmm. What about the way Congress presently handles allegations of sexual misconduct? We've had a lot of talk about that, Rachel. The slush fund, in some cases, we taxpayers foot the bill for alleged misconduct of members of Congress. And we don't even learn about the misconduct, do we?
No, we're finding out all sorts of things now that we didn't fully realize were happening. The process seems to be incredibly convoluted. Most of it is confidential. The fact that taxpayer money is used to pay out any sort of settlements in these situations. You know, there's been some parsing of that because John Conyers' office paid a $27,000 settlement in 2015, but that didn't come from the Senate slush fund. That came from his office budget. It's still taxpayer money. And so, you know, we're learning a lot about the process. I also think, to your prior question, you know, we're learning about the formal procedures of the institution. But I think what we're trying to navigate more generally, and, you know, there are a lot of scripts that we use in politics, kind of standard ways to get through a crisis, mm-hmm, and weather these sorts of situations. And we've seen a lot over the years. We've seen a lot of politicians try to deal with infidelity and accusations. You know, we go back to Bob Packwood and we go to Clarence Thomas, and, you know, we've seen this play out. I think one of the things that a lot of these members are struggling with is, what is the script now in a changed environment? How can you weather this? Is it possible? And if it is possible, what is the best tactic to do so?
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation with Rachel Caulfield, Tracy Osborne. It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts on the revelations we're dealing with, first of all. Later in the program, of course, we want to get to efforts at rewriting the tax code. Also, the threat of a government shutdown. What is that, December 8th, possibly? We'll talk a little bit about that. But first, we're on the continued sexual assault, harassment allegations that not only are peppering Congress, but also the world of media. Matt Lauer, we heard about this morning. So join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. What about, Tracy, Congresswoman Jackie Spears, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand? Now, they have written proposals to change the system. How much do they want to change it, and do they have support?
You know, I mean, this is a great opportunity for, you know, especially Kirsten Gillibrand has really a history of dealing with sexual assault in the military. And, you know, this is really an issue that she already has some ground on. This is an opportunity for them. But there's a real question here about what you do to address this problem. You know, you just kind of searched for the word. Is this sexual assault? Is this sexual harassment? You know, sexual misconduct is not really a crime or a tort or anything. You know, it's it's an admission of guilt or an accusation. And we're seeing in these media cases, you know, this immediate response of firing. And in Congress, we're seeing this kind of what do they do? Do they go to the Ethics Committee? And so that's really the place where they might have some effect, is defining a middle ground between kind of other people's outrage and then if you can really be, you know, go into a court over these kinds of accusations.
Congressional Republicans had a press conference this morning. House Speaker Paul Ryan says that sexual harassment has no place in any workplace, especially in the U.S. Congress.
Whether it's as a former staffer or now as a member, walking into this Capitol building, I cannot tell you how each and every day I just feel the honor, the opportunity, and the privilege it is to work in such a place. That's how so many people feel. But the fact that some people end up walking these halls, are subjected to a threatening or hostile work environment when they came here to serve their country, to serve their ideals, that's wrong. That's a disgrace. We cannot and we will not tolerate that kind of behavior.
Paul Ryan went on to highlight legislation that would require training for congressional members. He says it will also be evaluating the issue of sexual harassment accusation settlements that have taken place in the past. Rachel, your read on what's going to happen? Could we come out of this with no changes, or are you betting on changes?
I think there will be some changes. You know, the mandatory training, and particularly mandatory face-to-face training, which would require new staffing in Congress to provide the resources to do that. But it assumes that the fundamental problem here is that people don't know what is right and what is wrong. And I think that's an incorrect assumption. I think most people know that this is wrong and, you know, assume that they can get away with it anyway. And so the extent to which you go beyond training then is important. And I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what that looks like. You know, true to form, Democrats are kind of saying, look, we're in the minority. We can't do this on our own. Where are our Republican colleagues on this? They're the leadership. They need to be doing more. And then, you know, we see the Republicans saying, no, 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 we take this incredibly seriously. Democrats need to step up and, you know, make some decisions as a caucus about how they want to deal with Conyers and Franken in particular. So we're seeing partisanship start to emerge. This is how Congress operates. This does seem to be a rare example of a time when we might see Democrats and Republicans capable of working together to make some changes to the procedural elements of this problem in Congress.
A strange twist on this sexual harassment allegations story that's been bubbling for several weeks in our press, gathering headlines. Last night, reported, I think, broke by the New York Times. Now we're talking again about that Hollywood Access video. Remember that video in which candidate Donald Trump admitted to groping women, bragging that being famous meant you could grab women by the genitals. Donald Trump publicly apologized after the release of that much publicized video. People close to him say that he has privately now for months expressed doubts that the voice in the video is his, privately questioning the authenticity of the recording, as reported by the New York Times. He has repeated the claim to advisors in recent weeks and even a Republican senator earlier this year. Sources are saying, let's listen to that apology immediately after the release of part of it, after the Hollywood Access video. This goes back to 2016. Soon after, he apologized for those comments. Let's hear a bit of the apology.
I've never said I'm a perfect person, nor pretended to be someone that I'm not. I've said and done things I regret, and the words released today on this more than a decade-old video are one of them. Anyone who knows me knows these words don't reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize.
I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize. Going back to 2016, now we have the story from the New York Times that he is casting doubt on the authenticity of the video, which he clearly there admitted to. Rachel, also in that original apology, he went on to refer to Bill Clinton's own problems of misbehavior, and he suggested that Hillary Clinton had been attacking those women that had come forward to accuse her husband.
And then, of course, brought the accusers to the debate.
Exactly. That's the moment. Yes. Thanks for recalling that moment. Stranger than fiction.
Stranger than fiction.
Stranger than fiction. So this latest story, what do you make of it?
Well, you know, I think Donald Trump lives in his own reality TV show, and he has spent a lifetime crafting a narrative about who he is. I think during the campaign, there were moments when he followed the advice of staffers who had done this a long time, and he, you know, he came out and apologized to put this behind him. It was a huge firestorm, but I don't think that was his first instinct. I don't think he wanted to do it.
So it was sort of a forced apology.
That's my own interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly, I'm not the first person to say, it's incredibly difficult to get into the mind of Donald Trump. But you know, it's pretty clear this is a person who is exactly who he is, and he has crafted a life story and a vision for himself relative.
Contrary to a lot of data. He's questioning again the authenticity of Barack Obama's birth certificate. Now, again, also repeated the claim that he lost the popular vote last year because of widespread voter fraud. Zero evidence to back that up.
Yeah.
But these continue in his mind, according to these reports.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. I think they continue in his mind.
Mm. Comment on that, Tracy?
That's right. And I totally think it was the difference between candidate Trump, who thought he was in trouble and might lose the election and conceded to advice, and then President Trump, who feels, I think, really emboldened and like he can use this strategy of denial. I mean, he has several claims of sexual assault against him that have been made. If the story keeps getting bigger and bigger and pulling more people in, he might actually have to deal with this. And so my guess is he's kind of using diversionary tactics at this point, posting Muslim videos, you know, talking about the birth certificate controversy. This is totally designed to get the heat off of him from having to talk about these accusations against him.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, Tracy, before the show, you mentioned you, then-candidate Trump, pulled Bill Clinton's misbehavior into his conversation, his apology in 2016 as a candidate. You actually grew up in Little Rock.
I did.
And you remember Bill Clinton as a governor and becoming president?
I do. I was 17, actually, when he was elected in 1992 and was downtown, just, you know, watching the event.
Your research focuses on women and politics and state legislatures and Congress and political behavior. So when you look at a time when you were in Arkansas studying up close Governor Clinton, and of course there were rumors, there was talk about then Governor Clinton, and of course we all experienced what became of that as President Clinton there in the White House. How do you compare the two issues now? What we experienced then in the 90s and what we're experiencing now in 2017?
I think it really shows a cultural change. From having grown up in Little Rock, it was relatively well known that he was a womanizer. And I think most people at the time when those accusations became public in the 1990s were pretty sure they were true, right? They weren't hard to believe. And people sort of brushed them aside. And I think the big difference now is there's a lot of people questioning whether that's okay. And even going back to Clinton's accusations and saying, you know, we should have done something different. That's a huge cultural change to kind of more respect the right of people to come forward and to actually do something about sexual harassment and sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. In the 20-some years that have passed, do you also see a big change, Rachel?
I do see a big change. And I think that, you know, the areas that are drawing the most attention right now, Hollywood and the media and politics, these have been places where, you know, charismatic, interesting, engaging, usually generally attractive people have congregated for years and gained a great deal of power. And I don't think it's a mistake then that we're seeing these men who have been involved in these industries, you know, we're seeing more and more what that culture has created. Politics is no different than a lot of these other industries in the sense that you have a lot of very charismatic, very ego-driven, very powerful people congregated in a small space. And I think that's historically been the kind of environment where these men have been empowered to act in these ways. And the cultural shift now is leading to a much broader understanding of what that means for the women who are trying to work in those environments as well.
Mm-hmm. Before we take a break, a few comments on the Republican candidate for Senate in Alabama, Roy Moore. Of course, Donald Trump says he believes Moore's denials that he behaved inappropriately with teenage girls and effectively endorsed Moore's candidacy from afar. On the other hand, Donald Trump praising women for coming forward after accusations were made against Al Franken, for instance. So they're a different way of handling it. How do you see, Tracy, to you first, the White House handling Roy Moore here in the final days of the campaign? Was the election on December 10th, I believe.
It's really dangerous. You know, I suspect Roy Moore is going to win. And then there's going to be a big question that the White House and Congress have to deal with about whether he should be seated, you know, whether the Ethics Committee should take him up. And this news that broke about the Project Veritas
We'll talk about that in the next half hour, yes.
Actually, I think really probably was a good thing for Roy Moore. Now he can say, oh, well, these other accusations were false, too. And so I'm really not sure what's going to happen with Roy Moore. It's an interesting case.
The White House says now there are no plans for the president to go to Alabama to campaign for Roy Moore. Of course, the Republicans would dearly like to hold on to this seat, presumed up until very recently to be very, very safe. What does Donald Trump have to weigh here, Rachel?
Well, he obviously has to weigh the extent to which engaging directly in this controversy also implicates the 13 women who have come forward to accuse him. And so this is an incredibly difficult thread the needle moment for any White House, or would be for any White House, to try to figure out how to negotiate this. We happen to have a president who is not prone to nuance, and I think that makes it much harder. You know, Roy Moore has been a difficult candidate for the Republicans for a lot of reasons. Early on in this primary season, right, this was a huge divide between the establishment Republicans and the Steve Bannon wing of the Republican Party. So from the very beginning of this campaign, Roy Moore's candidacy has been problematic for the party. And when you kind of add all of these allegations into the mix, it creates kind of a toxic situation for the party. And I'm not sure there's any good way for the White House to address it at this point.
Right. Allegations. We have to say that Roy Moore has consistently denied here. I mean, how do you treat a whole bunch of allegations that nevertheless are denied?
And Tracy, that are remarkably similar to each other.
Okay.
I mean, there does appear to be a pattern.
Right.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think he thinks probably his only option is to deny. And unfortunately, with a lot of victims of sexual assault who come forward, you know, unless there's corroboration, sometimes people don't believe them. And so he's probably hoping it'll go away.
Okay, we won't go away. Yes, we will, for a few minutes, actually. Tracy Osborne is with us, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of political science at Drake University. Politics Wednesday, if you hadn't guessed already, if you just tuned in. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a moment. And Tracy mentioned this Project Veritas. We'll talk about that. The Washington Post said it was the target of an apparent sting operation, sought to plant a false story to discredit the newspaper's investigation of sexual misconduct allegations. We'll hear a little bit of audio from that sting operation. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of Politics Wednesday. Rachel Caulfield and Tracy Osborne on board this week. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Tracy Osborne of the University of Iowa, the political scientist we have on board this week to pick over as we evidently will have forevermore into the future. Far too many political developments to properly digest. Let's talk a little bit to start off this half hour with this Project Veritas sting. On Monday, the Washington Post said it was the target of an apparent sting operation that sought to plant a false story to discredit the newspaper's investigation of sexual misconduct allegations against Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore. Now, the Post reported that a woman's name, Jamie Phillips, shared a dramatic story, got in contact with the newspaper. Her story could not be substantiated. The story was that Moore impregnated her when she was a teenager in 1992 and that she later had an abortion. But the Washington Post said the woman, who was interviewed several times over 2 weeks, was seen entering the New York offices of Project Veritas. That's an organization that targets mainstream media organizations, seeks to discredit them. Here's a bit of the audio recorded by the Washington Post. This is reporter Stephanie McCrumman of the Post questioning the woman, Jamie Phillips, about her alleged experience and why she contacted the Washington Post.
This is a GoFundMe page,
yeah.
Which has your name on it, Jamie Phillips.
Yeah.
And it has also, let's see, where was that? It lists a donation from the person that you said was your child, mm-hmm. Taylor. And it says that you're moving to New York, and that you've accepted a job to work in the conservative media movement to combat the lies and deceit of the liberal MSM. I'll be using my skills as a researcher and fact checker to help our movement.
Okay, there's a little bit of it. The video goes on 10 or 12 minutes. I watched the entire thing, riveting to watch online of this attempt to plant a false story. Now, the Washington Post did not run this false story. We want to make sure that's clear. But they did run the story, of course, of this attempt to plant a false a story. How surprising is this, Rachel Caulfield?
Well, this is kind of the MO of Project Veritas, undercover reporting where they hope to go in and get people to say embarrassing things or things that will discredit them. In this case, the idea, of course, was that the Washington Post would be caught on some sort of video or audio recording expressing the fact that they were anti-Moore and they wanted to see this story published so that his campaign would ultimately fail. That didn't happen. It was an inartful undercover effort here. So I don't think it's terribly surprising in this day and age. I do think that it has the potential among those who are most likely to already support Roy Moore. It has the potential to essentially reinforce their idea that the mainstream media is against them, that these women who are coming forward to make allegations against him are also making up fake stories.
But here in this case, we have the Washington Post doing due diligence.
Absolutely.
Here and saying this is not a story and checking it out and exposing it for what it is.
So absolutely.
That should
what? That should.
That should improve the credibility of the Washington,
Post,
for instance. Tracy, weigh in here.
I think that's right. It should impact how people feel about the Roy Moore story. But I think the people who read the Washington Post or who see this story are not necessarily the people who are supporting Roy Moore. And so, with kind of this divide among who consumes what news, it may be that what filters down from this Washington Post story only reinforces Roy Moore's supporters and how they evaluate the other women who made assault against him or who made accusations of assault against him.
Mm-hmm. A few other things we want to get on to before this hour ends. An update on the Republican efforts to overhaul the tax code has been in our news. Yesterday, this overhaul gained some momentum, didn't it? Clearing the Senate Budget Committee. Now, I think something else could happen this afternoon, some sort of procedural vote. Perhaps Tracy or Rachel, you are up on it more than I have. So the Republican leader is still trying to secure votes. They need to pass the bill through the Senate. What have you been hearing lately, Rachel? I've been hearing this trigger mechanism intended to satisfy sort of the deficit hawks who are not quite on board yet.
Right. So there are So first of all, the committee vote yesterday was kind of a big deal in the sense that two members who had expressed very strong reservations, Ron Johnson and Bob Corker, both serve on that committee and both voted yes on the bill. And so that's kind of a very strong signal that some of those who have been most outspoken about their concerns are willing to come on board and trust the leadership in negotiating on those issues that are most important to them. The procedural vote this afternoon would be a vote to bring the full bill to the floor of the U.S. Senate. The hope is to bring the bill to the floor. The leadership has essentially guaranteed that there will be a series of changes made to the bill, and that's kind of where the negotiations are going to be the trickiest for particularly Mitch McConnell, who has said this is like a Rubik's Cube. And it's going to be some tough negotiations. And then the hope is that they will vote on the full bill, hopefully by Friday, maybe early next week. But right now, one of the big issues is the deficit hawks are concerned about the extent to which this will contribute to the deficit. This is a big bunch of spending. So, you know, the general estimate is it's about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. And that's where the Republicans have said that's their limit.
Zooming out a little bit, how is it possible that a major overhaul of the tax code that hasn't been done in a generation at least can be done without any Democratic support? Is that right, Tracy?
Yeah, it can be done mostly because of the procedures that they're using to get this bill through. Right now, they're using a process called reconciliation. Both parties have done this process to kind of thwart the rules that allow the minority in the Senate to have some control over the process. And so I don't think it's something you can accuse one party of being more guilty of, mm-hmm. of doing. But this takes away the filibuster, right? It takes away the minority's right to kind of slow down the process. So really, that's how they can push it through.
Here's a headline from the Washington Post. Tell me, how accurate is this? Deeply unpopular Congress aims to pass deeply unpopular bill for deeply unpopular president to sign. Rachel?
That's about right.
Is that right? Accurate?
Well, right now, polls seem to indicate that about half of all people indicate that they oppose this tax reform that the Republicans are putting forward. President Trump has low approval ratings. He has had low approval ratings since entering office. So they have hovered somewhere between 30% and 40% approval. And Congress, of course, has the lowest approval of any institution. And so that's routinely, 15% to 20% of Americans say that they trust and approve of the U.S. Congress. So objectively, polls are telling us that's all correct.
Mm-hmm. So, Tracy, where does that get the Republicans to have a, in the words of that headline, deeply unpopular bill passed through Congress when we have a midterm election in 2018?
I think, you know, at this point, they kind of know that they're in trouble. It's just how much they want to delay the trouble that they're in. I think what they're thinking right now is with the midterm close, this bill is not going to affect people before the midterm happens. And so they're hoping to pass something so that they look like a productive Congress before the midterm comes around and kind of, you know, taper off some of the things that Rachel described, you know, the bad polling about Congress approval. I think they're sort of hoping the bad stuff from the tax bill is going to happen after the midterm.
Tracy, what would you say are the chances this will make it to the president's desk in some form when we reconcile it between the House and the Senate?
If you'd asked me that 2 weeks ago, I would have given a pretty low probability. But I think seeing this like trigger mechanism which basically says that if the economy doesn't grow at the rate that people expect, that it'll trigger an automatic rise in business taxes. Seeing that put into the bill, you know, I think there's still some issues with the realtors and, you know, these mm-hmm. Republicans from states with high state and local taxes. But some of the things that I've expected to thwart this bill have not really happened. So,
and I see now just within the last few minutes, the Senate has begun to debate the tax overhaul bill. So it is in process, had perhaps made that procedural vote hurdle. Mm-hmm. Rachel, have you been seeing the chances rising for this to get to the president's desk?
Absolutely. And there's a lot at stake for Republicans here. They need to claim some legislative victory. The trigger mechanism is one issue. Pass-through corporations are another issue. We have Senator Rubio, who particularly is dedicated to
increasing deductions
for child tax credit.
But doesn't this give a cudgel to the Democrats, a tax bill they will say that is tilted toward business and the wealthy?
Well, if they message that well, then sure. The Republicans are hopeful that, as Tracy indicated, that they will get this through, that Americans will not see an immediate effect prior to the midterms. They will be able to claim success and that economic growth will continue. So they will be able to take credit for economic growth based upon predictions of how this tax reform is going to affect the American economy.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield with us, Tracy Osborne, our political scientist, Rachel of Drake University, Tracy of the University of Iowa Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about those empty chairs yesterday. Yesterday, Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi skipped a meeting with the president that was to have focused on the budget. After the two informed the president they would not attend the meeting at the White House, the president and the Republican congressional leaders went ahead with the talks, nevertheless, without them. That left Trump with empty seats on either side of him. Name cards, I think, were presented there. Schumer and Pelosi, name cards were putting with their titles. He also criticized, sat next to those empty chairs for a picture-taking session, and criticized the lack of turnout here. These comments came shortly after we heard in the context here that the North Korean long-range missile test had happened, and Trump suggested that the Democrats don't want to help the military to respond to threats like North Korea.
Well, if that happens, I would absolutely blame the Democrats. If it happens, it's going to be over illegals pouring into the country, crime pouring into the country. No border wall, which everybody wants. I got elected partially because of a border wall. You look at the military, we want strong funding for the military. They don't. So many things. As an example, they want high taxes. We want cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to reform. We're going to simplify. They want high taxes. We want low taxes. So there's a lot of big differences. So we'll see what happens as to shut down. We'll see. But right now, things have changed over the last 2 hours because 2 hours ago a missile was launched. I think that will have a huge effect on Schumer and Pelosi. I think. We'll see. We're going to learn very soon.
Okay. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi said they pulled out of the meeting because of a tweet that Trump sent earlier in the day attacking them as weak on illegal immigration and bent on raising taxes. Tracy, wise for the two Democratic leaders not to show up with 24 hours approximately of hindsight?
I'm not sure. If they were there, I'm not sure they would have had much of an effect on it. But, I mean, the way Trump is posing it is really off of what's actually happened in Congress the last few times. The reason they keep coming to these deficit problems is they reach their debt ceiling. They're using supplemental appropriations, which, you know, aren't long lasting. They're kind of using stopgap measures over and over again. But it's really actually the Freedom Caucus, the conservative Republicans, that are often throwing a wrench into these budget negotiations because they don't want to see the deficit rise. So, you know, I think it's from the Pelosi and Schumer point of view, it's hard to say, but my guess is Trump knows that this is going to be a nasty negotiation. And so it's another diversionary tactic, you know, talk mm-hmm. about other things and try to blame it on them.
Rachel, explain to us now the Republicans control both chambers of Congress. They control the White House. But in this case, with this, they do need the help of at least some Democrats.
They do need the help of some Democrats. This is a bill that can be filibustered in the Senate. There's no way to negotiate this through reconciliation, so they're going to need to get to 60 votes in the Senate. But in addition, in the House, you have those deficit hawks and very conservative Republicans who are concerned about government spending, who are likely to defect. And Democrats are going to have to make up those votes if they're going to pass a spending bill. And that's a tough call. Democrats right now are kind of holding it hostage, saying, look, we're not going to vote for this unless there are protections for the so-called Dreamers, the DACA program. And we're going to find out very soon whether or not the Congressional Hispanic Caucus kind of summarily removes its support and says we, under any circumstances, without those protections, we will not support the spending bill.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of negotiation that has to go on here. I actually think that this was not a smart move by Schumer and Pelosi, largely because there were going to be cameras in the room anyway. That visual is a striking visual. And if you go back to other government shutdown situations and scenarios, you know, you go back to example for to Newt Gingrich complaining that he wasn't given a seat on Air Force One. He looked petty. And, you know, I think there's a risk here that Schumer and Pelosi look petty.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller. Nick is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Nick. Coming up to the end of the program, I ask you to be brief, but welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I guess a quick question that I would have would be, there's always the discussion that Democrats raise taxes and Republicans are trying to cut it, but I'd love to hear about maybe about the idea of waste and why. Is there anything that the both parties can agree on that the government currently is just spending an exponential amount of money on, and that we could actually see any semblance of compromise? Or is it just going to be we're wasting money on the wall and then the other side debating away on those regards?
Okay. Anyone want to jump in to Nick's question there?
Well, this is one of the ongoing kind of systemic and institutional issues in Washington, is that for every program that spends money, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of those programs, all of them are there because there is some member of Congress and or constituency that feels that that money is absolutely essential. So it would be difficult to find any area where you would have widespread agreement that money is being wasted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we move on, I'm going to give each of you, because over the Thanksgiving vacation, I played Monopoly. I hadn't played it for a long time. So each of you get $100 in Monopoly money from me, and you get to bet it, all of it, on one or the other. We're going to have a government shutdown or not. Rachel?
I'm going to bet all of it on no.
No government shutdown.
No.
Are you
government
with her?
Shutdown.
I agree. All of it on no government shutdown.
Okay. You're on tape.
we'll see you use those tapes.
I lost my Monopoly game, by the way, even though I had some really good properties. One last thing this week before we go. Let's talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Goes by the letter CFPB. We had two competing acting directors showing up for work to lead this federal government administration. Now, this is something that was created in 2010, the first federal agency to focus on protecting people from the excesses and scams of banks, credit card companies, mortgage issuers. Sort of like we already have an agency that protects us from bad toasters. Consumer products, right? So this is to protect us from bad financial products, is the way I understand it. Correct me if I'm wrong. So anyway, Richard Cordray, director, resigned last week, a holdover from the Obama administration. Cordray named a longtime bureau employee, Leandra English, to be a successor. And also, though within hours, President Trump appointed his own pick for the temporary job, Mick Mulvaney. That's a familiar name. So we had a showdown yesterday in federal court. The district judge refused to block Mulvaney's appointment. Rachel, what are the implications of Mulvaney's appointment to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Well, let's start with the fact that this is the wackiest story out of Washington in a little while.
And we've had a lot of whack.
Yeah, there's been some some good contenders for that prize. But so Mick Mulvaney, who is President Trump's director of Office of Management and Budget, his budget director, coming in to lead this CFPB. The CFPB has never been popular among Republicans. And when it was originally established in the Dodd-Frank Act, Republicans fought mightily to have a bipartisan board that would govern the agency rather than a single director who would be largely unaccountable because of the independence of the agency. They lost that fight. Democrats wanted a strong directorship. in losing that fight, of course.
They shot themselves in the foot, perhaps.
Well, they really spent a long time criticizing the CFPB. Now that they have Donald Trump in the presidency, they see a great opportunity to change the direction of the CFPB. All of a sudden, a strong director seems like a pretty good idea. And Mick Mulvaney has said very directly, you know, I'm not going to set the place on fire. I'm here to run it, but it will be run differently. Mm-hmm. And so you can expect significant changes in how we approach our job.
Tracy, what do you have to add to that? We have just a few seconds left.
Yeah, I think it's a little microcosm of all the problems in Washington of two competing directors bringing different donuts to win over their constituencies.
They did actually do that.
Mulvaney actually showed up with donuts is the word on the street. So, you know, I think Mulvaney will take over, you know.
Well, next time we have you on, Rachel and Tracy, I will bring the donuts.
Oh, good.
If you remind me. Okay, whatever. Tracy Osborne, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, associate professor in political science at Drake University. Tracy and Rachel, it's been wonderful to have you on this hour with your insights. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, we'll look at how President Trump is reshaping the judiciary, not the Supreme Court, but the federal courts, the district courts, and the appellate courts. It'll be an interesting conversation. Join us tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.